Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaskan Conversation. I'm Robert Hannon. On this show, I talk with columnist and librarian Greg Hill. Not content to just serve those who already like to read, Greg started a program that sparks interest in books in the young.
By fourth grade, most American boys stopped reading for the fun of it. This has gone on for decades. And so what we came up with this Guys Read program was have fun books. The focus is just fun. This is just going to be fun reading. But I couldn't ask my staff to do the program. We were stretched so thin, that meant that one of the other story times would have to go away. And I didn't want to do that, so we hired a coordinator who helped me, and we did a pilot program at three schools, Hunter, Denali, and Barnett. And right away, we could tell this lit the kids up like nobody's business.
I hope you'll stick around following the news. Welcome back. One of my favorite Kurt Vonnegut quotes doesn't come from his novels. Writing about censorship, he noted that the day-to-day frontline troops protecting our rights to gather information weren't found in our elected bodies, but at the desks of public libraries across the United States. That's certainly true of my guest tonight. Greg Hill is probably best known locally through his weekly columns that have been featured in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner for decades. Parents may also know about Greg's work starting the Guys and Gals Read program in elementary schools, which brings together adults reading to young readers with books that combine vivid images and exciting plots. I first met Greg when he was director of the Fairbanks Borough Library System back in the 1990s. In fact, Greg asked me to serve on the borough's library commission, a position I still occupied. I was recruited not too long after a couple of censorship issues arose about the library. One sought to remove a work a woman found objectionable. The other concerned a display case where civic groups could elevate their work in the public eye. Unfailingly polite and politically adroit, Greg navigated the libraries and the public through those rough waters and also managed to spearhead campaigns to expand the libraries. As I often do, I began my conversation with Greg asking about his upbringing.
I grew up in Abilene, Texas, which has to be one of the capitals of hypocrisy in the known universe. When I was growing up, it was a dry county, and it had more churches per capita than any other city in Texas. It also had the highest beer consumption. Fortunately, my parents weren't in the mold of a lot of folks there, but my dad had a group of friends that were what some people referred to kindly as bohemians. They referred to themselves as the bastards of Blackacres because they rented this property, this little farm, where they could have their meetings as a group of men, poets, musicians, artists, radio announcers. It just was in all these different arts forms, but they just all happened to be friends. They all happened to feel the repression of living in Abilene. So they would meet once a week at Blackacres, and they actually incorporated as the Bastards of Blackacres, the BBA. And so as they died off, you know, their obituaries saw this, a charter member of the BBA. And nobody knew what that was, but when I was a little boy growing up, I said, where's Dad? Said, oh, he's meeting with the bastards. I went, oh, well, that's because no women or children were allowed. One person, one bastard each time was responsible for cooking for everybody. So anyway, I kind of grew up in this literary, musical environment that was different than a lot of my classmates in school. The biggest thing was that one of the biggest things in Abilene to this day is football. Football rules. High school football rules. And I started playing football in fifth grade and learned the formations that we would be using in high school. But then after sixth grade, you know, go to junior high, and about half the guys stopped playing football. The other half of us didn't. You know, we weren't the quitters. And this kind of continued each year. Is really emphasized by the coaches. It really gets into your head. You're not a quitter. In junior high, I scored touchdowns, you know, that sort of stuff. I was a running back and, you know, sort of a glory position, and was heavily recruited by a particular coach from high school who was recruited a number of us individually and as a group to continue playing in high school because we knew it was going to be a lot harder. It was a big step up. And one of the things he said was, you know, if you get hurt, we want you to tell us because we don't want you playing if you're hurt because we want to get somebody else in there that's not hurt. We don't want you to get hurt worse. Which was news to us because we had already learned you never tell the coaches that you're hurt. You never admit it. And in high school, as a matter of fact, I went out for the team in right off the bat, it was like the first week, I got a really big concussion. I had several repeated head injuries, one play after another, and after the third one, I woke up in the shower an hour later and have no memory of what happened or how I got there. Felt weird, kind of sick in my stomach, and passed out when I got home. My parents took me to the emergency room where the team doctor was on duty, so he couldn't charge me because it was a football injury. He couldn't charge my parents. So he told my parents I just had a brain contusion. I could go back to practice the next day. And so I went back to practice the next day. I got whacked in the head, and then I started seeing double. And the coach that recruited me was showing us demonstrating plays that we were going to be using with a half of a line, you know, a center, a guard, a tackle, an end. Him as the quarterback, the fullback, and me as the running back. And I was supposed to get the ball and go in between two of the guard and the tackle. And every time he turned to hand me the ball, I would run smack into him because I didn't know which of these guys to go, you know. And so I go in the middle and I just hammer him. And then after the third time, he said, "What's going on?" And I said, "No excuse, sir," because we were told to say, all you could say was yes, sir, no, sir, no excuse, sir, on the field. And he got madder when I would say, "No excuse, sir, no excuse, sir." And he was shaking my face mask, which, of course, was great for the whole deal. And he said, "You tell me what's going on or you'll be off the team." They couldn't kick you off the team. The only way you got off the team was when you quit or if you had poor grades or behavior in school. So I told him I wasn't quitting. He said, "Get off my field or you're insubordinate." And so I had to get off the field. That was a Wednesday. So Thursday, I came out to practice, suited up. We went through calisthenics and agility and stretching. And then when they started the different drills, I just went off to the track around the field and ran the whole time. And then the next day, I did the same thing. Then it was Saturday. Sunday, my vision cleared up. And Monday, I went back to practice, and I started doing the drills again. But I was marked, and it was evident to everybody. The message was out: you do not tell anyone what they do if you're hurt. And so I was put through some really horrendous drills, meat drills they were called.
Well, that kind of must have left a sour taste in your mouth
it did. I had nightmares about practice for years. But when they hand me the football to run with it, I'd be so hyped up on fear, really. So a 10-second run seemed like half an hour. And also, my consciousness was slightly up and behind watching my body do these things because there's no thought involved at all.
Sort of an out-of-body experience.
It literally was. And I've heard of this from other running backs that have had that experience. The problem was if they told me to run between the guard and the tackle and there's some big old guy there, I wasn't going to go there. I was going to go somewhere else. And I ran junior Olympic track. I was one of the fastest boys in town until they integrated the schools. That changed. But I was one of the fastest white boys in town at the time. And I had a deceptive speed. So if I could get outside, usually a lot of the defenders would misjudge how fast I was going. And I'd make these long runs. And it was just ecstasy. And I would have dreams about touchdowns, too. Till finally, I was so beat up after my junior year, I told the coach, "I just have to quit." I mention all this because football haunted me for years and years and years. But I signed a letter of intent to play college football at a small liberal arts school that actually recruited me. But then they fired their coach during the summer, and he took all his paperwork with him, so they didn't know who the new players were. And I was at that school for a week before the coaches spotted me. I figured they just weren't interested in me, cause since I never heard back from them. I didn't know about the coach being fired and all that. And so I thought, well, that's that. But also, it was a very rigorous school. It was Austin College in Sherman, Texas, the school was established before there was an Austin, Texas. Sam Houston was on the original board of directors. You know, it's the oldest school, you know. It's also limited to 1,200 students, and they have a 10-to-1 student-teacher ratio. So it's an intense school academically. And
what did you major in?
Comparative international relations.
Why?
I wanted to be a diplomat.
Seriously?
Seriously.
What put that in your head, Greg?
It was a vague thing of wanting to make the world a better place. Well, anyways, I knew if I played football, my grades were going to suffer, and it would be Hello Vietnam, because I had college deferment, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam. But also at college, that's where I met my wife, Claire. And also, that's where I got involved with student government. And that's just these opportunities. And also, my advisor in comparative international relations, he had graduated from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. This was his first teaching job. I was going in for my first oral exam. I was a freshman, And I should never have been taking his class, which is like a junior level class, but my first advisor at Austin College had put me in some classes like that because I want to be a diplomat. I said, well, okay, there you go. The big portion of our grade was an oral exam. And it was my turn to get examined. So I went in and sat down, and this phone rings. Oh, could you excuse me a second? So I sat outside for like 15 minutes and finally came back. Turns out he'd just gotten a call from the Undersecretary of State commending him on his doctoral dissertation on nuclear disarmament. And he was elated. And he'd never seen anybody as smart and as bright and as with it as I was. And I made an A in his class. So we became tight friends. So I ended up going to American University. It turns out that the acting head of the department, of the political science department at American University, was from Houston. And she had worked in the State Department in Ghana. Well, my specialties in comparative and international relations was Western Africa and India. I was primarily interested in Nigeria and India. So that's what I studied. So we connected because I was this poor guy from Texas who I'd always had an advisor in college. Suddenly I don't have an advisor, but so I went and talked to the head of the department.
So this is graduate school?
Yeah, at American University. And so okay. It turns out she knew about a grant program they had at the State Department. And they hired me and a graduate student in civil design, a civil engineer, to come up with strategies to keep third world people on the farm instead of migrating to the big city where the infrastructure is so outstripped. And you know, how can you do this? And so that was the assignment. But anyway, we wrote our report and it was shot down. We basically said you ought to use intermediate technology, the Intermediate Technology Institute that E.F. Schumacher had established in Britain. They had a tractor.
And he's small as beautiful.
Small as
the
beautiful.
Book.
Yep. They had a tractor. It had a winch and a long steel cable. And these little things they ran off of Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine. Hmm. The idea is you put a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine somewhere in the region. And if it goes wrong, if it breaks down, take that one off, put this one on. Also, they're very easy to work on. We turned in our report and our supervisor said, that makes a lot of sense what you're saying, but do you know how much the John Deere Corporation contributed to Gerald Ford's re-election campaign? And I said, no. And I said, that's why we're going to be buying John Deere tractors. I said, but there's nobody there to work on them. There's no roads to get them to the farms. He said, I know. But how much did John Deere contribute to the... Well, and also, a key moment came when I was at the World Bank Library. I had a stack pass to the Library of Congress, Robert, which these are, congressmen don't have those. Certainly their aides don't. They have to get special permission. But I had a stack pass. I wandered around. But I also had a stack pass to the World Bank Library. As I was leaving one day, they had a spinner, like we put magazines or comic books on in a grocery store or something. But they had different articles. And one caught my eye. It was at eye level. It's called The Sterility of Equilibrium Economics. I went, what? That's it. And I looked at it. It's from a guy from India. What he stated was that as it stands now in the U.S. educational culture, if you're in an economics department, and you try to incorporate a theory that a competing department at another school has or a portion of their theory into the local theory, your dissertation is not going anywhere. If you deviate in any way from the prevailing, whether it's Marxist or Keynesian, whatever, if you deviate at all, you're professionally dead. And so the only thing to do is to turn inward more and more and more, define terms, define the definitions of terms. And this started me think what the key to that was is what actually is the philosophy of social science? What makes political science a science? What makes economics a science? What's the philosophical underpinning so I can come to terms with this? And nobody taught anything on that at American University. And we moved back to Texas because Washington was so expensive. And I went to graduate school at the University of Texas, and I was the comparative international relations student, and I was ripping it up. I mean, I was really doing well, but I started, there was gnawing at me. And this huge university, none of the schools had any sort of philosophy of social science. But I TA'd for a visiting professor from India who was teaching Soviet foreign policy. And at the end of the course in May, he invited Clarence over to his house for dinner. He said, what are your plans? I said, well, I tell you, I'm so frustrated because I can't find anybody to teach this philosophy of social science. What's the underpinning philosophy of what makes social science a science? He said, oh, I could have taught you that, but it'd have to be a readings course. And he said, it'd have to be a 6 hours readings course at least. And I'm only going to be here the first session of summer schools. You'd only have 3 hours of coursework then. And I said, I really want to. I begged. And finally, he relented. He was trained at Oxford. And so that was what we did. I read a book And on Monday, I went to his office and talked about it. I read another book. And on Wednesday, I went to his office and talked about it. I read another book and went to his office on Friday and talked about
it. Whoa. So, and I'm guessing these aren't easy to read books.
No, but they all built up to a book I've got in my study, in my most important bookshelf. One of the prominent ones is The Social Science is Sorcery. And what he said was, he said, social scientists today fulfill the same function in society that sorcerers did in the Middle Ages. They use this mysterious technique to produce ambiguous results that they express in a sort of a confusing institutionalized jargon. The purpose of it is, it makes us all feel like we know what's going to happen for a little while. And when it turns out it doesn't happen like that, they said, oh, well, if we had known about this factor, that factor, of course. I was furious because I'm really going somewhere in graduate school. And I cannot do this. And I threw the book across the room and dropped out and started delivering flowers. Also sent it to a good friend of mine who was on a full scholarship at Stanford in the PhD program on studying the presidency. He threw it across the room, moved back to Austin, and started painting houses. He ended up being the number three guy in the Treasury and the director of the U.S. Mint and other things. But I was delivering flowers.
Not bad,
and he
for
was
a sorcerer.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with librarian, raconteur, and passionate bibliophile, Greg Hill. We'll hear more following a break. I'm Robert Hannon, and this is Northern Soundings. Welcome back. Let's return to my conversation with Greg Hill. Greg not only helmed the Fairbanks Library System for years, he also started the Guys and Gals Read Program, which recruits adults to read to elementary school kids.
At lunch, I'd been invited by a friend from Austin College. You meet me at the Capitol, and I went to his office. He said, okay, I've got to give some printouts to my boss. He's going into this little room off the main house floor chamber, where they do TV shots, you know, because it had the big seal and all that. So we're in line there. There's several other representatives waiting to go in there. And behind us was this great, big, huge guy. I mean, real big, 6'5", 450 pounds, Dave Allred. And my friend said, Mr. Allred, this is a friend of mine from Austin College, Greg Hill. And he said, well, you went to Austin College? You know how to read and write. You want a job? And I said, yeah. So that's how I went to work in the legislature.
Well, what kind of lessons did you learn in get me from there to library?
Well, it's a pretty short jump, actually, because 4 years before I was hired in 1977 to work with him by Mr. Allred, each member had a desk on the floor of the House, and that was their office. And there was a pool of secretaries who'd call somebody over and dictate to them and get letters out and that sort of stuff. But that was the whole staff. By the time I was there, they'd increased it, a secretary and me and the representative. So I was the entire staff other than the secretary. And so he'd give me assignments and say, okay, when I give you something like this, I want to know what's the party thinking about it. He was a Democrat, and he said, what's the party think about it? But more important than that is, what is the average man in Wichita Falls, Texas, going to think about it? That's where he was from. He said, and more important than that is it right or is it wrong? I want to know those things from your opinion. And he also wanted to type it, and I didn't type. He had a master's in journalism from Columbia, and could type 120 words a minute. He said, well, I said, I can't type, Mr. He said, that's okay, just make sure it's typewritten. That's why my typing skills are like they are today. But anyway, but he was a noble guy to work for. I went to work there thinking that there's going to be some bad apples, but most of the people there for the right reason, to make their communities, the state, a better place. But no, it was getting money, getting your profession promoted, getting power, attracting women. All those took much greater precedence with most of the members there. one of my first assignments was Dave asked me to go to the Legislative Reference Library and get some quotes on tyranny of the minority. But that little library works for the legislature, not for the state library or anybody else. And most of the state libraries in the country now base their cataloging system on the scheme developed at the Texas Legislative Reference Library, which simplifies, because you use the Dewey system or the Library of Congress system, and you get into something like roads, and then you've got road commissions, you get road development, you've got road construction, road materials, you get these call numbers that are going to be an arm's length long. And so they came up with a way of shortening all that, which is still, you know, it's a crackerjack library. And the director was the only one on duty that day, so he helped me look for this quote. And we became pals. I spent a lot of time in the library over the course of working there. I worked there 5 years. Dave was defeated. He did not campaign. I went to work then. I was hired by a guy from a labor union outside Houston or in Pasadena. I thought, he'll be good to work for. He's going to be an okay guy. This guy turned out to be a horrible guy to work for. And I was just, after the session, we were at each other's throats acrimoniously. But I also knew that the name of the woman that he'd been dancing with at the Broken Spokes Saloon every Thursday night that I'd asked the press to not mention, you know, that I'd gotten his fat out of the fire several times. And I reminded him of that. And that's why he wanted to never, ever say anything bad about me. And also I was going to take unemployment for 6 months, and he hated unemployment. And that way I was able to stay at home with my new baby, Hannah, for 6 months, because I'd missed the first 6 months of her life, but I had the second 6 months.
Nice.
Yeah, but anyway.
So how did you get to libraries?
Well, this is what happened. I'm up in the library at the Legislative Reference Library talking to Jim Sanders, the director, and he says, well, what are you going to do? Who are you going to work for next? I said, I can't do this. I'm taking it personally now. I can play nice. I can get along with people I really don't like. I can see the purpose of compromise. I said, but I just can't do this anymore. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, why don't you go to library school? I said, there's a library school? There's a school for libraries? And he said, yeah, of course there is. And there's one right here in Austin. The University of Texas has a great library school. If you go to library school, I'll hire you as my nighttime reference librarian. And then when you come out with your library degree, you have a step to the professional ladder. And I said, but I don't know anything about library. And he said, but you know the legislature. You know who the characters are. You know the committees. You know what an enrolled bill is as opposed to an engrossed bill and all that sort of stuff. But I was actually a glorified page, sorting bills, shelving books and stuff. But that's what got me in the library school. And my plan was, okay, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go into library school, get my degree, and I'll go into places like, you know, county seats, you know, remote counties, and set up an office where I would hire paralegals to do legal research for law firms using the Westlaw database that was brand new then and had real arcane search terms. And I think that would have worked. But the first semester of library school at the University of Texas, it's like law school and medical school. There's no oral exams. There's no dissertation. They flunk you out the first semester. They figure out who floats and who doesn't first semester. And it's team taught by a school librarian, a guy who'd been at the Pentagon in cybernetics for years, and it was an awful teacher, really nice guy, just an awful teacher. And this guy, Sam Witten, who was the only professor at the library school who had spent most of his career working in libraries as opposed to teaching about libraries. And when he talked about the role of public libraries as the people's university, as the children's doorway to learning, as the first line of defense and intellectual freedom, all these things just lit me up. I said, I'm getting chills every time. I'm right now. The cause is noble. The cause is so noble.
Well, let's turn then, because I want to get you to Fairbanks eventually, but this is a good point, I think, to talk a little bit about your passion about public libraries. For transparency's sake, I will mention that I've been on the Library Commission for a while, and I've... In fact, you were the guy who recruited me to it. But let's talk about the power of public libraries. What's the value of a public library in society today that has the internet?
Well, for one thing, there's that saying, if you want to get a million answers, you go to the internet. If you want to get the correct answer, you call up the reference desk at the library. They might not know the answer, but they'll find the source that they can direct you to it. When I began in library school, we actually had to pass a one-day test on a PC, personal computer. And I remember clearly professor saying, this machine has 65 kilobytes of storage, of memory. In your lifetimes, you're never going to need more than 65 kilobytes. Anyway, well, that sure
so changed. So much for that prophet.
Yeah, that changed pretty quickly. But also, I was trained in how to, in the reference class at the University of Texas, it was difficult too, that 95% of our grade in introductory reference was on the final. And the final consisted of 100 random questions we might be asked at a reference desk in a public library. But the thing was, we were responsible for 800 different reference sources that we had to know. And the way you answered the questions was not what the question was asking, but where you would go for the answer. And no notes.
Wow.
Pretty intense, huh?
Pretty intense.
Now, if I'd gone to the University of North Texas, there would have been a requirement to know 350 sources. Yes, there's a big difference. But you come out of it thinking, okay, here I'm at the reference desk, which was my favorite part of librarian. I could be asked anything in the known universe when the doors open today. And the key is to figure out all the puzzles.
Yeah.
And without prying into why somebody needs to know something. We're not questioning why they want to know how to make a bomb. When I was in Russia later, doing library talks in Siberia, later the librarians there said, but what if somebody wanted to make it a bomb? Would you tell them how to do it? Yeah, of course I would. They said, You wouldn't report it to the militia? And I said, no. And I said, but what about the community safety? I said, well, the thing is, we have all these miners who do mining. They could be very well trying to figure out new types of explosives or how to use it correctly. Mine is not to question why.
Yeah.
Mine is to provide the information without bias, you know, or trying to outguess or think, oh, that's not right for somebody to know. It's very different now, because now I don't need to know 800 sources. I need to know how to use the internet and how to know how to use really good databases on the internet. And so now the job of the reference librarian is guiding people to the right sources. Here's the best place to look to get good information. Or here's where you can go to get contrasting points of view about the same thing. And that's the big role of the public library in the national consciousness, is as a place you can go to figure it out for yourself, to not be have to rely on the incredible deluge of disinformation and misinformation that's spewed out daily. I mean, right now we know that horrible things are happening in Gaza, but horrible things, even horribler things, are being published by supporters of Israel and supporters of Hamas. So you can't trust anything. But you go to the library, you can get a reasonable grasp on what you need to know. Sometimes you want to know privately, so you need good medical information. Sometimes you want to know how to do it yourself and you want to check that garage mechanic. So you need a good array of coverage of how to do car repairs. You know, there's certain things like that, home repairs. It's just a basic underlying wealth of information you can rely upon, as well as introducing your children to this incredible array of books that you could never afford to buy on your own. That's a big part of it. None of us, or very few of us, could afford to buy all the resources that are at Noeline Library. Mm-hmm. But together, by contributing a small amount, we can.
So tell me, what brought you to the Noeline Library, Greg?
Well, the first library I was hired at out of library school was in Odessa, Texas, or as we came to know it, Odesolate. It is horrible, horrible place. But it turns out that the public library was corrupt. I was hired as not as a reference librarian, but as assistant department aide, because I'd already been a reference librarian, thanks to the Texas Legislative Reference Library. But one of my jobs was to check all the new books that came in, and they all came with a book slip of where we bought it, how much it cost, and all that sort of stuff. And I started noticing, I said, these books are awful. I mean, they're just terrible books for a public library, particularly one in Odessa, Texas. One of the prime examples was there was a 3-volume to a 4-volume set of indexes to 18th century Ottoman poetry. Now, it wasn't the poems, it was an index that was broken that you didn't have the full index to, that they had paid something like $400 or $500 for. And that was the list price. What I found out was that only one day out of the year, the director of the library and two librarians would be flown to Dallas, wine and dined by the owner of a big remainder dealer. Remaindered books are books that were not sold by the publisher, and the publisher sells them to remainder dealers for pennies on the dollar. And usually when you go to a remainder store, you're paying at top 50 cents on the dollar. But when you're buying a bunch of them, it drops down to like 15 cents real quickly. But here's all these list prices. So I started photocopying all the book slips and putting them back in, sending them on. And the average, after like five or six full carts of books, the average copyright date was 1904. And the average price per book was $44 a volume. This is in early 80s where you could get a bestseller, brand new bestseller for 12. So something's wrong here. And this only they can only do it one day. You go there, they'd swat them, dot them, take them to this big warehouse, they'd pick all the books and take, and they'd all be shipped back and be processed and cataloged. They didn't buy any new books. They rented bestsellers, but they didn't buy any bestsellers. So it's when the rental date went up, you said to send them off, send them back. So the collection was becoming worse and worse and worse. Anyway, I played soccer. One of the guys I played with was the county attorney. And so I told him about this, and he said, yeah, give them to me. I'll pass it on to the county judge because I've already resigned. And he said, but the thing you got to know is, it's not just the sheriff's department and the library that's corrupt. He said, it's everybody, including the police department. You start shaking those trees, all sorts of monkeys going to be coming down. We were there for 9 months, nine long, long months. I was suddenly saw this opening for a job as the director of the Seguin Public Library down near San Antonio and got hired for it. They said, well, you've only been working in libraries 9 months. Why should we hire you? Why are you leaving this other job so quickly? And so I showed them the evidence. And that got me the job, that and the fact I'd worked in the legislature. And I knew how to get along politically because I was hired by a nonprofit board that ran the library. They got half their money from the city, half their money from the county, and they need somebody to get along with both. But we got out as fast as we could. So anyway, I went to Seguin, Texas, and 9 months out of library school, I'm running a, running a public library. And I was asking Claire the other day, when did we move there? And she said, it was April. I said, yeah, because then 2 months later, I have to put on a summer reading program. I don't know anything about summer reading. And my first speaker was the head of the, he was the national director of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, the leading mutual network at the time, who had retired to Seguin, Texas. And he did a show for these little kids on how to tell the difference between fake photographs of real flying saucers and real photographs. So it was a real learning experience there.
Oh, I'll bet it was.
But also, they didn't have any retirement. We wanted to get good retirement and benefits insurance. And so after 3 years, which is the sort of the usual stay for a library director moving up, it's about 3 years. And so I went to Corsicana, where if your child graduated in the top 25% of the graduating class of the high school, their full tuition would be paid to any university anywhere in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, our kids can make the top 25% because we had four. We had three kids then. Had our fourth was born there. But we found out how horrible the school district was. My wife's a retired teacher, and we were shocked at how bad it was. But also, it was more scandals there than even Odessa. It was incredible. I could give you a full program on that. But basically, it was rampant. Except at the library, I cleared up two scandals there.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Greg Hill. Greg is passionate about books, as you can tell, and the rights of everyone to have access to them. We'll hear more following the break. I'm Robert Hannon. Welcome back. Let's return to my conversation with Greg Hill. In the 1990s, as director of the Fairbanks Borough Library System, he successfully navigated choppy political waters that involved censorship.
How did you get to Fairbanks?
Claire saw a thing about this opening in Fairbanks. And my mom, that summer, coincidentally, had volunteered at Reese's Roadhouse in Delta, for the state park system, where you go up and she designed a wildflower walking trail for them and was a docent there. But she came to Fairbanks, saw Nolwing Library, said, this is a good library. and really started saying, why don't you apply for their opening? I said, well, I don't meet the minimum qualifications. I've run a staff of 10 or 12, you know, they've got 60. And they wanted someone with large staff experience. And they said, oh, well, just apply for it. You know, maybe you'll get an interview and you fly up here and we could visit, because she's a big traveler. And so I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to Chicago for the American Library Association anyway. And so I went there. And so like the day before I left, I called Fairbank, the North Nolene, and talked to the administrative assistant. And she said, well, everybody here's left for that's going to do the interview. But I knew they have an opening and I'll get you in on that opening. And she got back with me and told me the time and the day, and because everybody else was already in Chicago.
This is at the conference.
Yeah, in Chicago. Okay. And so I went to the interview, and nobody showed up. Nobody. So after 45 minutes, I've left, and I get this apologetic phone call from Jack Rasmussen, who was acting director. I'm so sorry. We forgot. We were confused. We didn't. Anyway, please, can you come back? Please come back. And so I said, well, sure. So I went back and had an interview, and we sat down. I said, so before we do anything, there's two things that might just eliminate me from consideration. One is that if I took this position, I would insist on working at the reference desk and helping order books. Those are the two things I love about librarian. And I know we couldn't work a bunch of shifts at the reference desk. I couldn't order a bunch of books, but I want to keep my hand in. And they all kind of looked at each other and said, well, at our library, it's a tradition that everybody works at the public service desk. And in fact, they had hired, they reopened the hiring because the guy they had hired before me, he was there for like a week or two, apparently, when he found out he was expected to work the reference, he thought that was demeaning, and he stomped off. So the second thing was, I said, I've got four children, and we still have some family in Texas, so we'd want to be able to go back and visit them once a year. And would the salary be covering that? And they said, well, have you ever heard of the permanent fund dividend? I said, no, I haven't. It turns out that year was the exact amount, $750, the exact amount for a round trip from Fairbanks to Dallas-Fort Worth. And so we all kind of looked at each other. I thought, well, still, I didn't meet the minimum qualifications. But they said, thank you very much. And so we flew back home. Claire picked me up in Dallas at the airport. And as we pulled in our driveway in Corsicana, we heard the phone ringing. And I went and answered it. And it was Jack Rasmussen's library. He said, we'd like to interview you. Can you come up in 2 weeks? And this was July. So it was in May, I wasn't looking for work. In June, I'm interviewing for this job I'm sure I'm not going to get. And then in the second week of July, I'm flown into Fairbanks, and my mom's delighted. Of course, she picks me up at 1 a.m. It's light, and there's people. There's a guy flying a kite, and they're mowing. I said, "What? This is just and it's cool, and it's moist, and it smells green, and I can smell some wood smoke. And it smells intoxicating." It was just, you know, compared to, you know, Texas, everything was blasted brown at that point. So it was
love at first smell.
Well, it was, but the problem was they brought my competition up too. And she was interviewed on Thursday. That's when I arrived. And Thursday night, they had a bake-off outside in Weeks Field. The library staff cooked salmon, of course. And that's where I met her. And she was every inch the library director. Really well-groomed, you know, and looked the job, acted the job. But she brought her husband, who's also a librarian. And he went around telling everybody what they were going to be doing and how they were going to change this and that. And that sent off red flags. And
you
so,
think?
And so then I go in for my interview on Friday. And the other big turning point, another big book that's on my shelf that we've talked about before, is the Tao Te Ching translation by Stephen Mitchell. And I had a couple days before I flew up to Fairbanks for the interview, I looked at it at Walden Books when there were still Walden Books, and thought, God, I like this. It's the first time. I'd been curious about it for years, but most of the translations were like the 1800s and didn't speak to me at all, but this really did. And he had his notes in the back to explain how he interpreted different things. And so I took that and read part of it on the plane. It's not something you blaze through like a novel or something, just read here and there. And so I go in for the interview, and there's about 20 people in the room, standing room only all the way around. The mayor, the chief of staff, the HR person, library commission, some library foundation members, the major supervisors on the staff, and they start asking questions. And what boiled down to, well, you know, the elephant in the room is, you know, you've never managed a staff this size. What's your approach to management philosophy? How are you going to do it? And I said, well, I prefer consensus management. It's all getting to a point where we can all agree and move this project forward. I realize that sometimes it's got to be a hard call by the director, But generally, that's the way I like to do things. And also, it's like Lao Tzu said in Tao Te Ching 2,000 years ago, that if you want to cook a good fish dinner, make sure you've got some good fish and then don't poke them too much while they're cooking. It just came to me in a flash. I've always credited Stephen Mitchell for, for getting me past that hurdle. And then I was interviewed by I was taken to lunch immediately after by the Library Foundation, which was essentially an interview. And then after that, I went back to the library where I was interviewed one by one by the supervisors or by the other degreed librarians. All the degreed librarians, I think there were five or six at the time, interviewed me separately. Then the supervisors and teams of two interviewed me. But the one that stands out is a woman who really didn't care for me very much. We never became close at all, but I respected her professionally. And maybe she did me too at some point eventually. But anyway, what she said was, what we need here is someone to go fight the battles across the river. Of course, Fairbanks is divided by the Chena River. The Borough Admin Center is on one side. The library is on another side. And that's where the politics came back into it again. Mm. No place I worked at as a librarian was any less political than the legislature. It was just a lot nicer and is a nobler purpose. I also found that it was this little corner of the world, this little part of Seguin, this little part of Corsicana, I can improve. I can leave it better, and I found it. Mm. But coming to Fairbanks, man, I was proselytized in Texas. You know, why is reading even important? Mm. Who needs books? In fact, one county commissioner in Seguin did say, I read a book once, it didn't do me no good. And of course, we made sure that ran in the paper.
Well, tell me.
Because that's how I inherited the column. When I was hired in Seguin, I was inherited a newspaper column.
Oh, no kidding. Well, all right. So what year was it that you got hired? And talk me through the big milestones of as library director here.
Well, see, there was the, like I said, in May of 1990, I wasn't looking for work. And in August of 1990, we arrived in Fairbanks. It was a whirlwind, to say the least. And housing was even tighter than it is now. But my mom was here and was able to find a duplex. One of the big milestones was learning the Library of Congress cataloging system, because I'd always used the Dewey system in the libraries I'd worked at. I've always considered myself a pretty good reference librarian. And I was eager to demonstrate that I had skills in this regard, but if you don't know where the books are, it's so that learning that was an initial milestone. The next biggest one came in 1992 when we had a big controversy about a graphic novel, Billy Budd KGB, in which it's the old Billy Budd story, but it's where Billy Budd is a KGB agent who's recruited out of an orphanage to become a KGB agent and had three frames in it that had some form of sexuality. Is very mild. You couldn't tell. It wasn't graphic at all. In the far distance, that sort of thing. But a girl checked it out, and her mom saw it and became outraged, and she was friends with a very prominent member of the Library Foundation. She didn't like this book, and so she went to see the borough mayor and the city mayor, the Catholic bishop, and the editorial board of the newspaper. Then she came to see me to tell me who she had seen, why she didn't like the book, and what was I going to do about it. And it turns out there had been a tradition at the library if somebody prominent had disagreed with a book, they'd go in the library director's office and somehow never be seen again. Well, I said, well, what we'll do is, you know, we'll take it before our professional committee and we'll look at the reviews and how it matches up with our criteria, and we'll vote on in a secret ballot whether we keep it or reject it. But we'll use the criteria that the library commission that was appointed by the assembly approved. And then if you don't like that decision, then you can take it to the library commission. You can appeal it. And we looked at the book, and it was by a well-established author, and it was well done, and it met all our criteria, so we voted to keep it unanimously. In private, it was a secret ballot, but it was still unanimous. So she did appeal it to the library commission because she had three really good friends on the library commission who were also on the library foundation. And they had an ally there, so suddenly there was four people that wanted to get out of the seven people on the library commission that wanted to get rid of the book. The uproar began in April, and that hearing was in May, but they didn't want to do anything about it about the summer because it's summer in Fairbanks. You know, you don't want to be having public hearings. They wanted really loud public hearings about this. So it was postponed until September, by which time a member of the community had filed a complaint against the King James Bible because they said, if you're getting onto Billy Budd KGB about sex and violence, let's talk about the story of Lot in Genesis. the slippery slope, as they say.
That's
anyway,
right.
The problem was that Mayor Sampson was in a bind because no matter what he did, he was going to tick off a big portion of the community. And so my advice to him was that he didn't want to be the one making the decision. And he rewrote the Library Commission ordinance to make the Library Commission the last administrative appeal. After that, it goes to the courts because it's a civil right. Because his borough attorney was saying, if you get rid of this book that meets the established criteria, I guarantee there'll be a civil rights complaints filed, and it'll be in excess of $10 to $15 million, and public libraries have never, ever lost these lawsuits. And one had just happened in Kentucky, this little town that lost $3 million. It was a town like 20,000 people. So, you know, it was pretty evident. So he didn't want to do that because he was clearing up a bunch of other lawsuits that had gone on that the borough had lost at the time and didn't want a new one. And so he made the courts the administrative appeal, and he increased the size of the Library Commission from 7 to 9 and appointed two people who thought the book was just fine. And so we reached a compromise that in October of 92 that we would keep the book at the reference desk. Anybody that wanted to could look at it until the Library Commission had a chance to review the criteria. And that would be done no later than February, the following February. And so they reviewed the criteria and they approved the established criteria. But it was a real good learning lesson for a lot of people. They saw quickly the Bible could be wrapped up into something like this.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal. And then a couple of years later, we had the Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays display go up at the library. And like we told people, it's not our display, it's our cabinet, but it's that organization's display. And this happened in 95. Also that fall, that October was an election, a bond election, for money to expand Noel Wien Library. And the vote was on Tuesday. The PFLAG exhibit went up on Wednesday. We won by 6 percentage points on the bond issue. That's a lot of campaigning by the wonderful library support group. At that point, the Library Foundation refused to support the expansion of Noel Wien Library because those same people were still ticked at because of Billy Budd KGB. And they said, well, this is a political issue. We're not supposed to be involved in political issues. So Sandra Stringer, who was Mayor Sampson's special assistant, shoehorned an organization called the Library Support Group, where she got Glenn Hackney, a very conservative former state senator, and Marianne Einiger, who was administrator of the National Education Agency, to co-chair it. Anyway, so there were several hundred people in the parking lot with this firebrand, this guy who called himself a rabbi, and he was, like, his mother was half Jewish or something, and he pretended to be a rabbi. He was well known in the community at the time, but he was a real rabble rouser. And he was trying to get everybody worked up to go, let's bash into the library and let's take that display out. But the minister across the street, the Lutheran minister, saw what they're doing, and he went over there, got on the back of the pickup, and he shamed them into leaving. And we recruited him to the Library Commission too right away. But that was a big controversy. Again, another learning experience, because we also, right after that, it was Right to Life display. And they showed great restraint. We were worried about, because we knew that some Right to Life organizations had put up horrible photographs that would disturb people, and that was going to get ugly pretty quick. The PFLAG display was all writing, except for one photo out of the newspaper. Some people read it, but it wasn't like something kids would be turned gay over.
This really underscores, you talked when I asked you about the value of a public library in the age of the internet, you talked about the power of a reference librarian as a guide towards finding information. But a couple of these issues here, it's a venue for ideas that the community can come together, disagree with maybe passionately, but there isn't that censorship involved.
Yeah, exactly.
Would that be right?
That's right. When Mayor Whitaker was elected, he asked me what were my dreams for the library. And I said to finish the expansion, because we did the expansion in 97, 98. It was supposed to go on and do the auditorium and all the stuff that's being done now. The other thing I said I wanted was 25,000 branch libraries. And I said, I basically want everybody that has access to the internet to be able to have access to really good, solid information from the library. That's what I mean by that. I said, but the other underlying all this is a community commons. You know, the library is a place you can go and just be. You don't have to do anything or say anything or buy anything or swear to anything. You can just go there and be there and be safe and secure and utilize it as you see fit. But thinking is just as important as everything else. You can't sleep there. But
unless the book is really dull.
Nah, we wake you up then too.
You retire from the library, but your commitment to literacy doesn't end. Tell me about the Guys and Gals Read program.
Well, it was in 2006. Things were changing so radically in the libraries that the generation before the libraries, when they went to the library with their parents, it didn't have video games. It didn't have databases. It didn't have online, free online tutorials by real teachers. You know, all these wonderful, powerful things that are there. So that it was, how can we get this information across to these families? And I'd read an article about a guy in New Hampshire who would go in a little town there, and he'd go in and read to boys at lunchtime. Oh, well, that's a nice thing. And so I fleshed it out a little bit in my mind, and then met with Ann Short, who's the superintendent, and said, what I'd like to do is to go in and read graphic novels to...
And we should say graphic novels is what, when I was growing up, would kind of be called comic books, right?
Yeah.
And I know that's a bad term for it.
In fact, that's been a big thing, because the first graphic novel to win the Pulitzer Prize was Mouse, about the Holocaust, in which all the characters, the Jewish characters, are mice. The Germans were cats, the Americans were dogs. But the point of it was that they were all, it's all true stories based off of the author's parents surviving Auschwitz. But what do you call it? It's not a novel, it's nonfiction. So it's actually shelved in with the Holocaust material. So our staff here developed the cataloging system that we use now. So in the Berry Room, there's a collection that's age appropriate there. In the young adult area, there's age-appropriate stuff there. And then we have others in the adult collection. And then in between, there's this section that's mixed in with the young adult section that has true comic books. A true comic book is like 35 pages long, technically. A graphic novel is longer than that, more expanded. It could be like an anthology of comics that are all related.
And quite sophisticated themes and character
developments.
Much
so. It's like Neil Gaiman, the author, said that comics are the gateway drug to reading. It's because it's a different form of reading. It's like books on audio cassette. It's a different form of reading. That's what I wanted to present when I met with Ann Short. I said, we'd like to do graphic novels. And what we'll do is, my plan is, we would read just part of the book and we would donate copies to the school library. She said, that's great if you focus on fourth grade boys. By fourth grade, most American boys stop reading for the fun of it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, nationally. And this has gone on for decades. And so what we came up with, this Guys Read program, was have fun books. The focus is just fun. This is just going to be fun reading. And it's going to be guys reading to guys, not men reading, not having a boys reading club that men would be involved with, but we'd have men reading to the boys. Each time, we would have a different set of men read to the boys. Each time, we only read the part of the book, and we donate the books to the school library. I talked to Ann Short in 2006. We began it in 2007. John Hill, who had auto service, donated the money to float it the first couple of years. But I couldn't ask my staff to do the program. We were stretched so thin that if I asked them to, let's do this program, that meant that one of the other story times would have to go away. Something else would go away. And I didn't want to do that, so we hired a coordinator who helped me, and we did a pilot program at three schools, Hunter, Denali, and Barnett. And right away, we could tell this lit the kids up like nobody's business. But the plan was, we'd get them lit up, we'd show them all these fun books, and at the end we'd say, we're going to have a party at the public library with guy games, guy grub, and more guy books.
Well, when did you introduce Gals Read?
Well, that first year we were at three schools. By the end of the year, all 18 elementary school principals had asked us to do it. And so we did it there for 3 years. And then there was immense pressure from the female side of the school population. And so we began Gals Read then. And nice. It's been Guys Read, Gals Read ever since. And then when I retired, they still didn't have the staff to take over the program. And so that's when we formed a nonprofit to keep it going, because it was so popular. Every year, the Guys Read, Gals Read books are the most popular books in elementary school libraries across all the grades. I've just worked with some amazingly committed librarians, and it's been sad to see the libraries in our school district be gutted like they have.
Then what's your forecast for libraries in the future, Greg?
They're going to be around. I mean, libraries have been around for 5,000 years for some very integral reasons. Invented writing? Well, who's going to write it? Who's going to keep it organized? Who's going to tell you where it is? Who's going to get it to these people but not to those people? That's the librarians. Public library really comes from the United States. They had libraries they called public libraries in Rome and other places, but you had to be connected. You had to know something. The information was restricted, is all that sort of stuff. But here it was a broad level of information that anybody could elevate or educate. Mm. All those type of things are important to a healthy society, but it's mostly healthy if they're able to say, well, somebody's saying this, somebody's saying that, and it's real important. How do I make up my mind? That there's a place they can go to that can be done fairly and unbiasedly.
Well, Greg Hill, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, Robert.
That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Links to Greg Hill and the Guys and Gals Read program are on the Northern Soundings website. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.